This is the Artworks Alliance podcast, where we discuss the value and transformative potential of participatory art. Hello, it is Thursday the 3rd of April 2025. I'm Rob Watson and this is an Artworks Alliance podcast, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Justin O'Connor, who's the author of Culture is Not an Industry. And Justin has joined us from Brisbane in Australia. How are you, Justin? And how are things in Brisbane? What time of the evening is it there with you?
Well, it's very nice in Brisbane, I'm sure, but I'm in Melbourne.
Oh, sorry, I thought...
We're all miserable people who wear black. They're not like Brisbane. They're all, you know, kind of out in the utes and things. No, it's... just after 7 o'clock, getting into autumn and winter in Melbourne. So yeah, too bad.
So we're heading into spring, and we've actually had a run of days where it's been sunny for more than 3 hours a day. It's been sunny all week. So So the mood here has lifted. We've got the daffodils have finished now, but the buds are coming out on the trees. So I'm not sure whether you missed the UK. So where are you from originally? Because I kind of recognise the accent.
From Bolton, really. I mean, I'd spent a lot of time in Manchester, which is both, you know, 10 miles and a million miles from Manchester. But just up the road. That's where I'm from originally.
Right, because I'm originally from Liverpool, and I lived in Manchester for a period. So one of the things that the book was recommended, and it was really one of those books that when you read it, it's like a things just crystallised for me. I had two responses to it. One was, I've lived through this. And the second one is, this encapsulates the agenda that we're trying to focus on and develop within the Artworks Alliance or within other areas. So you've kind of come at a very opportune moment, I think, for almost like a kind of a stop in the road to reflect on where we are and maybe think about where we are going next. So just tell us a little bit about what has inspired you to write the book, and what you think the kind of challenges are that need to be addressed. This is your quick overview, and then we'll get into the detail of that as we go.
Well, I mean, I've been involved in this field around what used to be called cultural industries, urban regeneration, culture-led urban regeneration. When I was in Manchester, I was in Manchester for 20-odd years, and in the 90s, I got there, I was there late 80s, early 90s, when I just finished university, and I stumbled upon, as many people did at the time, the Manchester music scene and let's say the Northwest music scene, because it's extended right from Liverpool right the way through to Leeds and beyond that. But anyway, very much interested in that, the power of popular culture and how it changed things, changed people, and how there was a potential that it might change the cities and help the cities. So I was very much into that 1990s thing about, culture does provide us a way of turning things around, because the cities weren't that good back in those days. But that was a basic thing. And I was a kind of, I got involved in creative quarters, the Northern Quarter of Manchester, for instance, early days, 24-hour city stuff. And eventually, by the end of the decade, we'd set up this thing called the Creative Industries Development Service and all that. So I was very much behind that. And I think it was that turn of the millennia that I became much more aware of some of the downsides of that agenda, both in terms of where it was going and also in terms of where we hoped it would go, but it never got there. So there was, in the book, I wanted to give a sense, at least, of the, I call it a utopian moment. There was big hopes in the 90s for this, and some of them were naive, and that's fine, but some of them were more than naive, and some were actually led to, I think, to quite darker aspects of things, which we might come on to. So I wanted to write this and say, we expected this, we wanted this, and this is what it turned out to be. And it's not a, oh, it's not a kind of, it's also a mea culpa, if you like. It's not just, you know, somebody robbed us of our dreams. We are, you know, there's something wrong with the dreams in the first place to some extent. We were very naive. But also how it was then used, especially by governments and especially by other actors, I would say, has been highly problematic. So I wanted to say that, but at the same time, I wanted to say, well, how else can we see it? Because I was very clear, and I was doing a lot of the writing and thinking during the pandemic, I was very clear that one kind of system, let's call it neoliberalism, you know, it's a very big word, but that system that somehow came about from Thatcher and Reagan was at an end. Now, it is quite clearly at an end. We don't know what's going to follow it, what it will look like. It might be worse. But we need some kind of vision to go forward. We can't just criticize the creative industries for being economic and all that. We need some real ideas going forward. And that's really what I attempted to do in the book.
I lived in Manchester at the end of the 80s, and I went to the Hacienda twice and I hated it. I thought it was rubbish. I didn't know what the hype was about. I didn't like the people who were there. Maybe it was the tail end of and you know, it's yeah. I preferred the little gay clubs in, you know, it's they were better. But it was a deindustrialized place. And but the bands, you know, bands like New Order, the Smiths, they were all kind of prevalent. That they had a very they gave this offer of a culture, but it wasn't strategized, was it? It was kind of it emerged from. I mean, culture is that thing of the Volk, it emerges from the people, and I think what you've described in the book is that then somebody looked at this and thought, well, actually, we can turn this into a system, and we can measure it, and we can package it up, and it can become an industry. And in a way, that is the antithesis of an emergent culture. So it becomes something which is, as you say, systematized, instrumentalized, and it becomes something which is driven not as an expression of common identity and sense-making by individuals acting collectively in a community, but it becomes something which is driven as part of an economic strategy. What kind of tipped the balance on that, do you think, to then kind of turn it into something which was, you know, of that kind of more professionalized, you know, overtly managerialized process?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, it's a complex moment and there's lots of interest involved. But, I mean, basically, in the 80s, the kind of, you know, the there was a big shift. You know, Margaret Thatcher, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we can't just all this money given to the art. You know, it's subsidy, it's welfareism. Show us the value for money. So it was kind of people used to say back then, oh, it's the bean counters. You know, it's the all that. So all the arts had to show. You know, for every pound spent on the theatre, there's car parking and people buying drinks and food, blah, blah, blah. You know, people came up with these little mathematical multipliers to show how good it was, those kind of things. So that was one thing that was going on, and that's not left us. That, in fact, that's got worse if you encounter the current funding system, go anywhere near the DCMS or those kind of people. It's run by economists. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. It's run by economists. But then, so is the government. So that went on. But the big change came out of the Labour and indeed New Labour, because same across the, you know, across the Atlantic with Bill Clinton and other people. The idea was that you know, this kind of dour, austere neoliberalism was ignoring basically the new forms of popular culture, new forms of aspiration. New young people, what would we call them, Gen X now maybe, coming through. And the idea was that, you know, communism's gone. The Cold War's ended. That opposition between, you know, capitalism and communism, the state and corporation. Actually, there was now a middle way. And it was very much represented by Europe. So small scale industries, SMEs, they used to call them, small and medium sized enterprises, grassroots. Later they became startups and those kind of things. So the idea was that there's a new kind of economy emerging. It wasn't about mass production. It wasn't about top down. It was very much about network grassroots production. And culture seemed an absolute expression of this. You know, back in the 80s, culture was kind of a bit of a basket case. But now culture was cutting edge, you know. And I think New Labour really embraced that. In fact, Chris Smith, who became the first culture minister, been to Australia a lot. And they, of course, the Australian Labour Party was very successful at the time when the British Labour Party were completely out of power. So a lot of people came over here. They saw people like Paul Keating talking about creative nation, how Australia can use culture to become, in this case, you know, open up to the Asia Pacific multiculturalism, popular culture, you know, new lifestyles. And New Labour wanted some of that, and quite rightly too, I suppose. So they picked up on that. So for them, the idea of culture, it was about a new economy. It was about new kinds of jobs that might be able to replace the old industrial jobs, because they're the Labour Party after all. You know, that's their constituency, theoretically. And but so the idea was that, okay, well, you know, we've gone through in deindustrialization, but the new people coming through, educated, a bit more hip, they've been through pop culture, they're the ones driven by creativity who would create new jobs, new opportunities, drive innovation, et cetera, et cetera. And this was the real kind of I don't think it was in bad faith, actually. I mean, it was a bit naive, maybe, but that's what the line that was driven. So so although it became about economics, a new economy, it didn't seem like just number crunching and statistics and things like that. It was a whole wave of creativity that was going to transform our cities. And we talked a little bit, you know, just then about Hacienda. You know, people like Tony Wilson, who I still deeply admire. I used to know him a little bit. You know, he was so great in what he, as we all know, what he did in terms of all those bands. But he completely bought into this idea that, you know, these bands were going to transform a city. And in fact, of course, they're not going to transform a city. We all know what happened. Property developers transformed the city. I mean, you know, they were helped by the music culture, but it didn't particularly help the music culture itself, you know. So all these ideas weren't immediately kind of, let's sell out culture for some economic gain. It was in a much more kind of imaginative kind of way. We're going to reboot the economy. We're going to reboot our cities around creativity and culture. And so that's where that's kind of where it came from. So as I say, it wasn't kind of a cynical managerial thing. It became that a little bit later.
I suppose in a way it's like a culture wash. The actual economic forces behind it, and it's put at the front to kind of give everybody a nice idea about, hey, this is change. I mean, and you need that, and a dynamic of social change, a process of social change that doesn't have a cultural element to it can't succeed, because if people don't buy into it. You need the image of, you know, a story for people to buy into, and part of being from Liverpool, a kind of, you know, the narrative. I mean, it's part of the reason I left Liverpool. It's like the narrative of, you know, the chauvinistic almost narrative about Liverpool or Manchester was so strong, and it kind of came from a position of weakness, so it was over asserted and over projected, but at the same time it gave people a sense of identity, to kind of that feeling of belonging and identity that went with it. You described, though, in the book, and I'm not sure about the detail of it, but actually, when you look at the numbers, the creative industries, as it's labelled, hasn't actually generated that much economic value and jobs. They're actually packaging up activities that take place in aligned, you know, corresponding sectors like software development, and repurposing that and designating that as part of the cultural creative industries. So that leads me on to ask the question about what and how has the definition of culture and arts shifted through that process.
Yeah. Well, so it's easy to get caught up in this, and because you get caught up in it, they are difficult concepts. People say, oh, it's just what's in a name. Back in the 90s, we call them cultural industries, and they have quite a long track record. Cultural industries is not positive or negative, actually. It means industries that some of them have a lot of commercial applications, and they're not just state-financed arts. There are a whole range of things. So most of popular culture, you know, it never gets any state benefits to do it, you know, that the whole thing. So cultural industries had a long track record, and a lot of people embraced it. London back in the 80s, Sheffield, if you remember, the Creative Cultural Industries Quarter. You know, I met Phil Oakey there, and it's all, this was going to be the new steel industry, all that kind of thing. So that was fine. But then when New Labour came in, their big launch in 98, their document, they call it creative industries. And most people were like, well, you know, cultural creative, or culture's creative. Right. But we were much more wary of it. And once the document came out, so the document there is a list of 13 sectors, and they're buried at the bottom, number 12, was software. Now, this wasn't video games, so they call it. There was another category for interactive software back in the day. That's what they call. This was software. And you look at the figures, and it was like 46% of all the employment. So this, I've always done this. You go look under the bonnet, go to the back of the report, through the appendix, and you find these big figures of 7, 8, 9, 10%. You know, London sometimes claims 10% of the workforce are in culture. That's a huge amount. And then you look at, well, software. And when I say software, this is not people doing games, computer games. It's a data analyst in a bank. You know, their software. Or design and marketing, graphic design, sometimes architecture. You see these things. I'm not knocking those things. Fine. I've got a problem with marketing and advertising, but they are there. But they are not what we would normally call art and culture. And so, you know, film, TV, radio, you know, new media, publishing, the arts, you know, the performing arts, the visual arts, the glam sector, you know, the galleries, libraries, archives and museums, all those kind of things that we normally call art and culture, and which all the pictures, you know, when they have the strategy and these reports, it's full of, you know, dancers, isn't it? You know, beautiful young dancers, you know, they are something like 2 or 3% of the workforce. And that's in a place like Manchester. And they're highly concentrated in certain parts of the city. You know, somewhere like Bolton doesn't have any creative industry, statistically speaking. It's too low, you know. So these, what we're seeing is this big workforce, the fastest economic growth, you know, big value added, based on what I would call a statistical sleight of hand. Because software engineers are not art and culture. And that doesn't mean they're not creative in their own way, but then so are financial analysts. They're very creative. Or doctors. Are doctors creative? Or scientists? But what we call art and culture is that people who make symbolic stuff. They make stories, images, pictures, complicated symbolic artifacts or products or performances. And that's very kind of fuzzy at the edges, and that's fuzzy is fine, but it's things like popular music, it's the films, it's television, a whole range of things, and it doesn't have to be high art or anything like that, but that's the kind of world that we're talking about. And in a way, that got wrapped up into this whole other sector of software development for one simple reason, well, two reasons. First of all, because you know, suddenly you've got extra workforce. You know, you can add, you know, another million onto your workforce. And when you go into the treasury to say, we need money, we're an important sector, we're bigger than this, this and this. That's one thing. But also, it seemed to connect with what was then called Silicon Valley or the dot-com boom. you know, it seemed to connect with this stuff coming out of the US, all about, you know, small startups, creatively driven entrepreneurs, you know, young, hip entrepreneurs, blah, 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 all these kind of, it connected with that. So of course, creative is much more sexy than culture. Because as soon as you say culture, it sounds, you know, string quartets, a bit worthy, a bit public sector, you know, those kind of things. So they loved creative, but it brought with it a whole other set of things that have not, we've not got rid of them, actually. We're still filled with them.
The definition of, I mean, I'm not going to try and pin you down on this one, but the definition of what art is, because I think you posted on, I can't remember which platform it was, about the removal of the word art in some public policy, is it in Victoria, and the language gets shift, if you like. It's a bit of a, feels like a bit of a bait and switch, you know, to just talk about creative. And I can relate a story to this, which is I taught media production at De Montfort University for 20 odd years. And we, back in the 90s, so this is 97, 98, we were in an engineering department. We had a growing number of students applying for the course. It was a skills-based course and electronic engineering kind of combined with media studies. So it was ahead of its time at that point. And we wanted to expand, and we were limited by the number of people that could go and do photography and video in our art department, which was in the art faculty. And so we proposed that we do stuff on desktop publishing. We had one of our colleagues who was an engineer, was a fellow of the Royal Society of Photographers. So we said, well, we're eminently qualified to do this. And we had a meeting, and the head of school in the art department turned around and said, you're engineers. We're the creatives. Why are you proposing this? And we'd won the argument at that point about being able to shift. And it was one of those moments that's always stuck with me about that policing of language. And but in a way, actually, now that I reflect on that, it's kind of like she was right. You know, there was this, what is this idea of what art and creative expression is? And what is this idea of what production and skills-based, you know, using technology is? And we need to make sure that the slippage that and the merging of these activities is actually understood, that art is a highly specific social and cultural activity, and that, you know, product media or content production, and I'm, you know, fully in favour of all of this. I don't consider myself as an artist, but I do turn out, you know, kind of blogs and podcasts and things like that, is of, you know, of a different value. Maybe, you know, I'm not saying it's of any less or more value, but there's an element there of her saying, no, actually art is something unique and distinct by its, in its own terms. How do you define that within, or how have you seen that shifted and changed?
No, I think art is, what we call art is something clearly identifiable right back to the first rock carvings, you know, 60, 70,000 years ago in Australia, the cave paintings in, you know, the south of France, a hundred other examples. It's quite clear that symbol making, using, you know, dance, some kind of rhythm, some kind of music, some kind of image making, some kind of performance, some kind of ritual, is coterminous with human Homo sapiens. That's quite clear. From the moment we emerged from the plains of savannah, we had something like that. So it is something specific. Of course, it's acquired, especially in, you know, in Europe, but it's acquired a whole set of, as you say, you know, assumptions. So well, it's Kenneth Clark and the Sistine Chapel, isn't it, you know, and a bunch of, you know, engineers. Who are you? But I mean, again, it's always fuzzy, but, you know, if you're talking about how to reproduce sound, that's a technical question. And you can't reproduce sound. There's no music industry without people who can do that. But then, you know, you think of the way in which George Martin, sorry, a bit of a cliche, but, you know, George Martin or Tony Visconti or whatever, those people were artists. I've forgotten his name now. What's it called? You know, the guy who did the Joy Division production.
Martin Hammer. Yeah.
Anna, yeah. You know, those kind of people, they absolutely knew the technology, but they were artists and they facilitated artists and things. So, and there's no, those kind of, there's all sorts of lines that get crossed over. But it's clear to me that what we call art, and that's there in the grime, you know, whether you're in a UK garage, all the way through to, you know, esoteric installation art, those things are using the senses, using the movement, symbols, images, text, sound, rhythm, to say something about what it is to be human. And that's it, that's what art is. It's complicated because some people say, oh, it's that's culture. And and this is the biggest, at the moment, this is something I'm trying to find a way to say it neatly, is something I'm trying to work on. But culture was always, humans are cultural. You know, we don't work by instinct. Well, a little bit, but most of the time we learn. We learn from our parents or the tribe or whatever how to behave. We're not driven by instincts. We're driven by culture and learning. And that's a kind of basic. But saying that is not the same saying it's everything is art. So I think art is a more heightened, a special part of that culture. And that's very difficult to identify in older traditional cultures, I think. But these days, I think certainly since, you know, the rise of the economy and the, you know, modernity, modern societies do divide things up in ways that are probably not all good. But, you know, the idea of art as a kind of a separate space. When I say separate, I don't mean in the Royal Academy or in the Sistine Chapel, etc. It's a separate space in everybody's house, in everybody's home, in everybody's persona. But it's not the same as other kinds of cultural knowledge, which are about learning. So often it's seen that culture is democratic, art's elitist, and I'm really against that idea, because for me, the idea of access to art, some kind of meaning-making through, as I say, music, image, words, sound, this is something we should all have an access to and be able to do. However, and I'll say this just before you go on to your next one, however, that's also a very complex ecology to allow us to do that.
The last week, I think it was, the director of Wigmore Hall in London, which is a performance concert venue, and he describes it as the kind of, you know, it's not community arts. He says we're the Olympics. We get the absolute best of the best, you know, the elite artists to come and perform at our theatre. But they've turned around and said, we don't want any more Arts Council funding, because they're asking us to be social workers and to not prioritise the arts that they represent. So it's kind of the we've maybe, and you use an image, a symbol. I think you mentioned the Ouroboros. Which, you know, is that kind of, it's a cyclical thing of, you know, moments of change. And it feels like we're at that period point as money, certainly in the UK, as money dries up, everybody being forced to reconsider and rethink through what and how they're doing things. And that kind of set of priorities of thinking that art has to serve a social function and a social need. You know, we still, you know, look at Blake and wonder what he was talking about. And there's, you know, that kind of visionary element of it. So you don't need to be part of a culture, you can be separate from the culture. In fact, the kind of often the most effective artists over time are the people who at the time that they were producing work were pilloried and were outsiders. Whereas the arts industry always kind of wants to bring things back to what's the best analogy that I can use? It's like you've circled the wagons and you're only considering what's going on within the camp, kind of thing. And nobody's out there doing the pathfinder. Nobody's out there looking for and using their intuition and their unconscious to to dream and to think symbolically, which implies a different relationship with the world. When you bring it back, it's the functional managers who are saying, okay, how can we turn this into an exhibition that then gets 20,000 people to visit it over 2 months, and you know, it becomes instrumentalized, or how many can we sell, or how many clicks can it get, that kind of thing. Whereas good art often is the stuff that is kind of, you know, very few people see at the time, and it can remain unhidden, you know, it remains hidden. So it's, that dynamic is always with us. I suppose the kind of moving this on to the proposed solutions for this is the connection with the ideas about foundational economics, and you know, the suggestion that we should stop looking at art and culture as businesses in themselves and think of them about part of the social needs of the economy. So, you know, why that they become part of the infrastructure of society that enables society to function, but they're not seen as something that anybody's ever going to make, you know, kind of huge amounts of money out of it for its own sake. What got you, how did you get into the foundational economics model?
Well, this might be a very complicated way to say it, but let me go back to that Wigmore Hall thing, because there's so many different strands in there. I came across it, I think it was in The Guardian or something, and I came across it. And, you know, strand one is they're not taking Arts Council money, also because they don't need to, because their audience is rich. It's right there, slap bang in one of the richest parts of one of the richest cities in the planet. So they don't need Arts Council money. So that's one thing. So bully for them, really. But the second thing is this image of the Olympics versus the community. So you can have your little gala day and your egg and spoon race, but we're doing, you know, we're doing the marathons under 2 hours. And it's such a terrible analogy. I know they've been driven into that because they're seeing all these elite sports people getting millions from the government. But nobody... This, what is excellence in the arts? It's such a terrible word. You know, is William Blake excellence? You know, it's absolutely staggeringly visionary. He bowls you over and things. You don't say, oh, William Blake, he's excellent. It's a terrible arts funding, arts advocates kind of thing. And also the other thing, community arts. So we don't like community arts because, I mean, it's good for, like, normal people, because they can, you know, they can go and have their little curry and they can go and listen to a few. It's so patronizing. So that whole thing is so terrible. And I think, well, yeah, all right, let's have community arts. I remember listening when I first came across Dizzy Rascal for the first time, or, you know, some of the, you know, that's to me, you know, who, or coming across Jungle in the mid 90s, I think, mid to, you know, I was absolutely staggered that somebody was making music like that. And that's not coming out of the bloody Wigmore Hall. That's coming out of some, you know, youth club in Tottenham, you know. And that's as powerful works of art, as you want to say, as anything that's coming out of Wigmore Hall. Now, I'm not attacking the Wigmore Hall in any way, but they're, you know, community arts for them is how to get people in there that don't normally go in there. You know, why should I, you know, what? I went the other day to a concert with my daughter, who's 18, and she wanted to see a bloke with a bow tie and a guy on a piano singing Schubert. And Winterizer, it's called, The Winter Journey. Well, you know, what? Oh, really? She said, yeah, I watched the film. There's a film called The Piano Teacher. And she said, I listened to the soundtrack of it. And there's a whole reasons why people can get into classical music and that world of classical music. And, you know, that's the community they should serve. But they always interpret it as somehow, I don't know, let's bring on the Morris dancers or, you know. So that whole debate is terrible. But I do agree with them on one thing, which is, you know, art centres or whatever cannot solve social problems that are created elsewhere. Doesn't mean they can then go off and be elitist. But if you're defunding education, if you know, 60% of state schools have problems of violence and blah, 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 all those kind of things. If we're more unequal now than we have been since the 1980s, if wages have stagnated since, 2008, and England's, you know, the UK, let's say, is going down the... And what? You want everybody to go, all the community, to join hands and go to the Widmer Hall? You know, it's a nonsense. So it's such a thorny mess of kind of false assumptions and false binaries there, and you somehow you've got to step back and just unpick all that, because so much is total nonsense. And I think we should have community art. All art should be community art. Everybody who wants to should have a chance to see it, hear it, do it. But to do that, they need, you know, they need the education. They need the fact that there's some, that, you know, there's libraries or concert halls of youth clubs nearby. There is access to, you know, kind of kit if you're doing music. There is access to other people who know stuff who could say, oh, read that. What about that? What about that? All these things should be there for people to get into, but they're not there. They're skewed towards London. They're skewed towards people with the money for all that, all obvious reasons, to skew towards people with education. And that's why I came back to that idea of foundational economy. And foundational economy, it was a group in Manchester. I keep saying it's not rocket science, and they would say it's not some clever. They're saying economies, you know, all this stuff about GDP and growth, actually, let's focus on what people need to live a decent life in common. And it's things like housing, cheap food, access to transport, public transport, roads as well, public transport, material, water, utilities. You need access to education, health, social services, you know, public administration, those kind of things. Fiber optics for your cash machines and your internet. Those are the basics. And they said, you know, most of the economies that when we look at them, and they're saying, you know, 60, 70% of people employed are working in these kind of industries, these kind of basic industries, but also things like small scale restaurants, fixer upper, garages, nail bars, you know, small scale high street traders, as we used to say. So they're saying this is the economy we should focus on. And when I read that, I just thought, well, what happens if we saw art and culture, as I call it, in this thing? What happens if we placed art and culture next to health, social services, education, basic material infrastructure? And that's where it came from. That was that thought experiment. What would that look like? And I tried to write it through.
That, I think, is the great... crystallization for me with this, because it brought together a number of threads of activity that I do in other projects and things as well. And it's the focus on cultural democracy and the provision of some kind of, you know, the universal basic service model is that in order to have a functional democracy and an economy where people can take risks, you need a certain level of development, social provision. So, for example, the housing market in the UK is so screwed. That was a slip. I was supposed to say skewed, but actually, screwed is a better phrase. Because the you can't take risks. Nobody will put their position on the housing ladder. If you were lucky enough to get in the housing ladder, you've done really well. The government, you know, we have a social, you know, it is state housing in the UK, because prices never go down. And when interest rates, you know, the economy is driven around keeping interest rates on housing an affordable level, and governments will do everything possible, austerity on the back of the poor. It's kind of a conversation for another podcast, but. What it does is it denies those other services that you need, so you can't take risks. And if you're creative and if you're entrepreneurial and you want to switch and change between different types of jobs. If you want to switch and change and live in different places, it's almost impossible in the UK now to be able to move around. So what you need is you need those basic services like buses, like communications infrastructure, provided on a universal platform so that everybody's got the same kind of thing. So nobody falls, you know, if you fall off the ladder, you're not going to be hard. You can still go to the theatre. You can still go to the library. You can still go to an art gallery. You can still, you know, you can still participate in our cultural democracy. And we've stopped thinking about the idea of cultural democracy. We see it, and you talk about this in the book really well, it's been privatised. So if you're wealthy enough to take your kids to a weekend to see a theatre, a musical in London, you probably, by the time you've got your train fares and your hotel, you're probably talking, for four people, you're talking about £1,000 for a theatre visit, which is just unbelievably expensive. And then it has this double effect. So what you end up with is the regional theatres and the regional provision is chasing the same kind of model. So what all you've got is Manchester, Leeds, Liverpool, Cardiff. They're full of touring productions that are selling the same kind of industrialised content. And I'm not saying industrialised media content and cultural products are necessarily bad, but it crowds out the space for alternatives, and people have so that lack of being able to take risks reduces people's imaginative capacity. So that's kind of where, you know, the reason we need cultural democracy based on this model of a shifted and changed model of social benefit, social value, is because we can actually then become more, we can become bolder, and we can take greater risks. We need, it's the problem with the UK at the moment is, we all know it's hoarding wealth is one problem, and the lack of guts in the government to challenge that hoarding wealth, but they might do it at some point. But the rest of it is a lack of imagination, because people are very cautious and they only want to protect what they've already got. So they're doubling down and sticking to the models that aren't working. It's like, it's frustrating. So for the Artworks Alliance to bring a group of, kind of freelancers and often, kind of maverick institutions as well. It's like, no, we want to work. And one of my colleagues, Abby, she talks about, participatory art is the hardest form of art to do, because you're taking people who've got no expectation. They've not been schooled that they can be creative or artistic. They come from that. And I think, what drives us in a way is to say that transformatory potential of active, engaging and participating in art. That's why it's important, because it enables somebody to see themselves in a different way and hopefully empowers them through that process, or at least gives them some kind of comfort as they struggle through their lives. And that's the, it's where's the conversations taking place about this? And that's why I thought the book was so important.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of what you've said there. In terms of risk, just generally, it's a cliche now to say that, in the 80s, you could survive being a punk band or being an artist, because you had the dole, you had cheap housing, you didn't pay for university that much, bit late. All those kind of things have gone now, and it's not just the UK, it's right across the board. It's same in Australia. It, kids don't leave home now until the late 20s, unless they have some, but it's so, you can't rent, all this kind of thing. Somebody sucked the air out of the system. Which is time to develop, time to breathe, time to mess about, all those kind of things. And that's certainly come through in terms of culture. And of course, the cultural institutions, they've got to show bums on seats, they want a certain demographic, they've got to tick their, the different demographic boxes. So they'll try to get different people in. In the book, I tried to say, well, let's turn it around. For instance, so rather than art galleries trying to say, you know, how many black people have come in? How many lower socioeconomic groups have come in? All that kind of thing. What about, you know, spending money on an audit? You know, that every local authority, what are the life chances of every citizen to access different levels of culture? You know, just how far is it to a library? How easy is it to get, you know, not just musical education, that's a big thing now in the UK, I know, but and everywhere, but, you know, to a school where you're exposed to, you know, creative writing or dance or art, you know, painting and music. How easy is it to get to what kind of library access, what kind of cultural space, what other, you know, what other kind of infrastructures are there in your local area that allow, even at just at a basic level, allow the average person, if such a thing anymore, but, you know, most people to take advantage, to take some first steps on both accessing, but also doing it themselves if they want to. Not everybody wants to, but how do you know, what's the state of the local social and cultural infrastructure that allows them to do that? And once you start thinking about that, then you're looking at it not from the point of view of how can institutions get, you know, poor black people into their things and tick their boxes, but let's, you know, what's in the communities? What are the chances of everybody to do that? And how do we provide it? What, you know, how do we begin to provide these kind of infrastructure? I call it that.
And it's about creating spaces where, you know, I can't remember the exact number, but it's something like in the 1950s, something like half of all teenage boys were in a skiffle band. Have I misremembered that? But I've heard it before. You know, the Quarrymen, yeah, and the Beatles, you know, that kind of stuff. You did your own music. You know, it's like your DIY kind of approach. Now, what you know, kind of young people get is, how can you turn this? What's your business plan? How are you going to market this? And all of that kind of stuff takes over. And it's perhaps the answer is to create spaces where people can explore things without feeling that there has to be an outcome for it, that there has to be something which is going to contribute towards changing. I think that we've got the cart before the horse, haven't we? You know, that whole expectation, as you say, this is the instrumentalization of it. You're using art for a purpose that, as you said, was to correct and fix social problems which come from other places. And actually, the mistake is thinking that art can do that, should do that, might be able to do that, when in fact, you just need to create the spaces where people can go. There's an argument at the moment about British television drama. And we've got this huge thing at the moment about the adolescence programme on Netflix, kind of most viewed programme on Netflix. I haven't seen it yet, but people celebrating this. But 75% of TV freelance craft workers, production workers, are out of work at the moment. There's a massive freelance crisis about employability in the arts. Freelancers in the arts are a massive crisis at the moment. There's just no work, there's no paid work out there at the moment. So you've got this challenge of people saying we need to invest in British television drama, and we need to be able to compete with the you know, Amazon and Netflix and Disney. And rather than saying, well, okay, look at how much money we've got, and let's work on that basis and say we've got X amount of money, so strip out all the TV, all the film style production stuff, and go back to using a television studio with three cameras, a group of actors, a writer and a director, and come up with something in that space. And it costs very little, but it's about imagination. And I think that's where the problem is, that people are obsessed with it being part of the globalized culture industries. It's become that rather than what are the stories that you want to tell locally. And we've hollowed out the middle in that sense, and there's very little. You know, you can set up a YouTube channel, and you know, I'm sure this is how it will work. You know, people can set up their own channels and do their own work and set up their own platforms separate from the culture industries, industrialized cultural industries and the globalized cultural industries. But the government policy process, and there's a question coming, is How in that context, how, what should we be saying to government? What should we, you know, what should be the message that we say, look, you know, you've got to look at this differently? What would be your advice for that?
Well, I mean, for the government at the moment and the DCMS and at that level, and many of the universities who love all this stuff, they say, oh, it's about economic growth, you know, a little bit of startup, a little bit of innovation, but it's about growing the sector because it's worth XXX amount of money for the UK economy or, you know, Australian economy or whatever. And right, they do very, very little analysis of the actual state of the sector. So you mentioned, you know, the technicians, you know, art and culture workers are in a bad way right across the board for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, ultimately you've got to say, it's good to have access to art and culture, but you've got to have art and culture to have access to something. So supporting, that's a very broad thing. But in terms of those kind of, in terms of the media production, you know, what's happened over the last 25 years? What's happened is a fragmentation of audiences, and that's not just a technical media analyst thing. It's a fragmentation of what we understand by a sense of community. Now, we have very complicated communities. You know, a nation is a very complex thing. But something like the BBC and the ITV back in the day had some sense of this wild, complex audience that they had somehow to attend to, and it gave it a some kind of context. Now that the sense of the community, the nation to which you are speaking, and the idea that there is a nation, you know, we're open and permeable and we're diverse and we're all global, but there's some kind of sense of an audience community that talks to each other, that needs to talk to each other, that needs to mediate between itself, to understand what it's thinking, you know, to deal with things like the, you know, the adolescent stuff. That's gone. And you look at what's happened, you know, I mean, and I say it in the book, and I've just said it previously, you know, whose idea was it to give over one of the most profound transformations in media and therefore in the social world to a bunch of psychopaths in Silicon Valley? Whose idea was that? When did we sit back? Actually, the state doesn't need to do that. They can do it for us. And it's not just media. It's, you know, going to the health service, go to schools, they're all run on Facebook, Google. They have permeated the whole of the foundational economy, but in terms of our discussion, they've permeated the media sphere. And if it's not the content, it's the software or the hardware or the platform. And they are now, you know, six of the biggest corporations on the planet by market capitalization are some kind of media company: Google, Facebook, Meta, Nvidia, those kind of things. So we've given over our common space of discussion, negotiation, enjoyment, art, culture, we've given that over to the platform whose main job is to sell us to advertising based on the data that we freely give over. You know, it's a huge catastrophe, and we know where it's led. We know we're here. We're here with Trump. We're here with, you know, the right wing taking over Europe. We're here with, you know, what's going to happen when, you know, there's probably not going to be an election in the UK for a long time, but if there was one for tomorrow, it's no doubt reform would get in some way. We've got this huge fragmentation, polarization. We've got, you know, young boys killing people, you know, that the adolescent thing, but also that kind of attention deficit. There's a whole series of social problems that come from the fact that we're a society, we're a complex society, we're supposedly a democracy, and yet the media, the sphere we use to try and communicate with each other is actually not ours, and it's not there to help us. You know, even though the old BBC, you know, pops on pompous Oxbridge graduate, you know, but they had some kind of commitment to serve the people, whether that's Dad's Army or Play for Today, I don't know. they had some kind of commitment to that. And actually, I think the working class were better portrayed in the 70s and 80s than they have been in the so-called private sector ones, you know. So our media sphere is controlled by people who are not interested in our welfare. They're interested in extracting our data and selling it to advertisers and keeping us, you know, these kind of things. They're not interested in us. They don't care about our welfare. So that's where, and I think getting that over to government and, you know, does your right hand not talk to your left hand? All these units talking about the social breakdown, is it anything perhaps to do with the fact that the whole world of media has been reduced to a data ploy and an advertising business?
You sum it up so well. It's the focus. I mean, it's interesting. Lisa Nandy, the culture secretary Secretary of State, for culture, media, and sport. I think she does get this, and she does look at place-based. So she's written about this, and you know, she talks about place-based development, place-based, you know, kind of arts participation. And I like the idea. I've started to use the kind of rule of thumb phrase about care. It's like, you know, most of our media, most of our arts institutions, that are set up to tell us what we should care about. And actually what we need to shift this to, and you've said this, you know, it's a welfare approach. It's what you care for. So we care for our neighbourhoods. We care for our local communities. We care for our town, with a place where we interact with people. We can care about our high streets. We care about ourselves and our families. And when you shift that model and you shift that perspective, you stop thinking that you've got to solve all the global, you know, often people say, well, we've got to solve capitalism first and we've got to deal with the psychopaths in Silicon Valley. It was like, well, while they're still doing what they're doing, we also need to start laying the groundwork for that culturally specific, embedded, place-based, people-based process. And that's where we can maybe get some traction and shift to saying this is about specific groups of people that we actually actively demonstrate that we care for, rather than just caring about the issue. You know, we care about racism. We're really concerned about racism, or we're concerned about homophobia, something like that. It's like, well, how do you deal with that? And that's where, you know, getting in, that's the hard work of actually getting into the functionality of that on a local level in each place with each group of people. And that's where the cultural democracy thing comes in, because that's where the empowerment comes from. So it's I've taken up loads of your time, and I'm not sure if you know, it'd be great to have another conversation at some point in the future, yeah, kind of feedback into this. Is there anything we've kind of that you know, an encapsulation of this that you think, you know, looking forward, that you see is, where's the positivity going to come from with this? Because that kind of, I think we kind of share a sense of frustration, and we're of a set, you know, we're of a particular generation and social experience, but we need to look and to go, actually, you know what, there are shoots here of where we can look at the growth and the change that might come. What's exciting you about maybe what we can look towards?
I mean, what I think is we should find ways of getting people to talk to other people, not on social media. Again, that's a kind of a cliche, but getting to do that. Because once you meet somebody, you can't, it's not like or not don't like. It's much more complicated than that. So finding the spaces in which more complicated communication can take place outside, you know, the kind of ways in which it's corralled in social media. So finding ways to do that. And that's, you know, and I've begun really to get back into the cinema recently, you know, not Netflix, but if you want cinema with other people, sometimes annoying other people, but, you know, it's a big thing in Melbourne, for instance. It's a really growing, it's really taking off. People go to the cinemas. And so, and you know, you're not talking to those people, but to sit and watch a film. I watched a Clute last night, for instance, a redoing of Clute. This, you know, to sit there in a room full of, in this case, 800 strangers, apart from the person next to me, 800 strangers watching something. It's a different quality of experience than Friday night with a bottle of wine, flicking through Netflix things. So getting people out there. So where are those spaces that people can meet? I mean, that's why libraries are so popular. But soccer matches, still just about, you know, even though they're owned by Saudi Arabia, most of them, but soccer is at still just about a space where people, you know, meet in that way, and other sporting events. We're getting people out there. Finding ways in which people can have a say about something. I was speaking to somebody the other week from Birmingham, and she runs a museum in Birmingham, and she said they had a citizens jury, I think they call it, citizens, you know, where they ask people, and it's well-resourced, you know, people are paid for the time. It costs a bit of money, like 30 grand or something, but bring a cross-section of the citizens to there to talk about, in this case, cultural, you know. And, you know, they were saying things like, well, you know, nobody's ever asked me about, in this case, Birmingham before. Nobody, you know, so these kind of forums, these kind of spaces, and just, you know, taking care, finding new ways to take care of the record shops, the little cafe, you know, that the high street in some ways, that you can't just expect it to thrive now. It will in posh areas because people got the money to spend on, you know, butchers and fishmongers, but finding ways to do that. And there are new experiments. There are stuff about community wealth building, the stuff about property trusts. There are a growing number of co-ops now, cultural-based co-ops, not just cultural, but cultural-based co-ops. There are a whole range of things where we think, well, we've got to do this in some communal way. We've got to think about it. We've got to find a way of moving the value. It's stopping the value being extracted from the local area, but put back into it. So those kind of things, and local media, you know, back to the community radio, thinking of different stacking systems, if you like, for social media. You know, why should social media be dominated by Silicon Valley? It's actually, we all know the technology now. It's pretty basic, he said, not knowing anything about it, really. But, you know, it's there. It's possible. It's quite easily possible with the will. So I think get out there, meet people, talk to people, find forums for people to do stuff, whatever it is, really, in some ways. One of the worst things about the pandemic is that it took out so many of those networks, you know, especially for cultural creatives, if you like. You know, I don't get much money, but at least I have fun at openings and first nights and club nights and things. And that went, and I still don't think it's come back. So it's finding a way to get people out again, get people talking, doing stuff, get people, you know, arguing to each other. Yeah, that's fine. But, in, you know, face-to-face, in complex, grown-up kind of context. And that seems to me the really imperative first step in any, you know, local community, get people out.
I've got two last questions for you. The first one is, what do you think Raymond Williams would think of this moment? Because you mentioned Raymond Williams a lot and a friend of mine, Russell, is a big fan of Raymond Williams, to the point that he does tours exploring, I can't remember the name of the town where he grew up, but he does that. Right. So what, you know, what would Williams say about this? You know, it's part of the long revolution. What do we need to think of as the way that we need, you know, who can we look back to say, actually, they were onto something?
Yeah, well, I did, when I was reading that, I went back to The Long Revolution, his book, you know, and Culture and Society just slightly before then. And, you know, really taken by that sense that, you know, it's got its ups and downs, but gradually you know, there is a sense of which everybody gets to be involved in culture, i.e. making their own, the meanings that affect them, that they get to make them or collaborate in making them in all sorts of different ways. And I think that went through the 70s and 80s. And people like, I quote him in the book, Mark Fisher, he talks about popular modernism, especially for Generation X's kind of thing. It's the idea that, you know, yeah, it's popular culture, like Joy Division, for example, but, you know, it's not, you know, it's kind of out there kind of popular culture. It's as dark as you want it, or as, you know, kind of experimental as you want it in some ways. So this idea that modernism, yeah, we can make a future, yeah, we can use art and culture, try and help us make that future. But it's also, it's, you know, it's me talking to my mates. It's popular in that sense. I think that's something that came out that's still there part of Raymond Williams. And I think, you know, the long revolution has been stalled, and it got stalled sometime in the 90s. And there's some great stuff happening all the time, but as there always will. But as a collective thing, that's the something we've got to go back to, you know, part of kind of reinventing the future and say, come on, you know, we've got to have some kind of viable future. Otherwise, we will destroy ourselves as a society. So what is our future? How can we get there? And I think art and culture and a faith in art and culture and saying this is an essential part of your lives. It's other things as well. You've got to make your money. You've got to live. You've got to eat and things. But you can't properly fully live without a full flourishing art and culture. And I think that's somehow that's the basic vision that we've got to do. And that's what perhaps Raymond Williams would say.
And then finally, where would you want people to get in contact with you or to find out more about your work? I'll put links in as well.
I'll put links in. Yeah, well, you can. I've got a little website. I think it's called justinoconnell.com, but you can always find it on, search for it. I think I'm out there on the internet, but there is a justinoconnell.com somewhere with lots of rubbish in there.
Brilliant. It's been fantastic. And I notice it's gone dark now where you are. So that's good. So you've been listening to the Artworks Alliance podcast with me, Rob Watson. If you want to find out more information about Artworks Alliance, go to artworksalliance.uk. We are a self-funded. We don't get any grant funding at this point for a community of practice for participatory or community artists and organisations. And we have some resources on our website and we run members events and various other activities that you might find useful if you're that way minded. So look forward to speaking to you in a future edition of the podcast. You've been listening to the Artworks Alliance podcast. Find out more at artworksalliance.uk or search for us on social media, Artworks Alliance.